Should be a cloudy day today. Seasonal temperatures, just some occasional morning flurries, no accumulation. A high of 27. Clear and cold overnight, a low of 10 above. Tuesday, mostly sunny and 29. Right now, wind from the north at 15. 22 degrees Racine, 23 Kenosha. Wind chill, 12 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is now 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, and a little later in the hour, you're going to hear my conversation from several years ago with Mark Bowden, the author of, among many things, a best-selling book called Hue, 1968, the definitive book about that important turning point in the Vietnam War. That was something discussed today on NPR's Morning Edition. But in part one of today's program, on a much lighter note, we're going to be talking for the first few minutes about all that is offered by the Racine Heritage Museum, a beautiful museum that celebrates the rich and fascinating history of the city of Racine. In fact, the website says it well, the Racine Heritage Museum, celebrating Racine County's people, showcasing their stories. And of course, there are many intriguing stories, particularly of innovation when it comes to Racine and the people who have lived here and the products that have been developed here. We'll not only be talking about the museum, but also about a major event that is coming up on February 10th called A Night at the Speakeasy, a major fundraiser for the Racine Heritage Museum. Joining us is Chris Paulson, who is their executive director, and also here is Jim Wardrop, who is on the planning committee for this fundraiser coming up, and he has been a big part of the Racine Heritage Museum family for some time. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. I think the last time I spoke to one or both of you was about the historical walking tours, and that's just one of many ways in which the Racine Heritage Museum brings the story of Racine not only to its own citizens, but from visitors outside who want to know more about the city and its history. Chris, how long have you been at the museum?
Wow, that's a lot of math. I started there as an intern in 1989.
Oh, is that right? That I didn't know. So you'll be celebrating an anniversary of your own next year.
That's right.
Has very much changed about the museum in the time that you've been there since you started out as a young intern?
Oh, immensely. We've really come full circle over the last 15 to 17 years with over the decades to move beyond what you would consider sort of a conventional historical society kind of presentation to a museum with exhibit environments that are very they're refreshing, they're stimulating, they're engaging, they're interactive, and we've really kind of focused the story very tightly around the diverse population and the amazing variety and diversity of its products, of their products over time. And, you know, just to kind of, we want people who visit the museum to know right away that they're in a very special, unique community. Hmm. And that's what everything that you experience at that museum should reinforce.
Right. So if people would have visited there back in, let's say, 1989, they would have been confronted with something that just from the outset didn't look like the kind of museum that it is now.
That's right. I recall a lot of paneling and little boxes with glass in front of them with little things in them and really not a lot of story.
Right.
You know, I think we've really made some tremendous changes there over the years.
Absolutely. I don't remember ever being there way back when, but certainly now you walk in and it kind of hits you right between the eyes right from the start. It has a it's an exciting story and it's told in exciting fashion. Jim Wardrop, what is your connection to the museum and how long has that connection been in place?
This is the first time I've ever seen Chris.
Right.
It's been a while. When I was at the Journal Times, we would do some things with the museum and that type of thing. But since Chris came on board, and after I retired, we just started to have monthly lunches and maybe just talk about a couple of things and what if this could happen or what if this, and that's the walking tours was one of the things that generated from this from our lunches, and we were excited about that. And then, of course, I've been working with Chuck Tyler and his book that he's had, and we've been having some book signings and things. So we utilized the museum for one of his book signings, and it was just amazing the people that came in. It's an ongoing process of how to sell a museum because some people haven't been in there for a while, you know, for a long time or ever.
Right.
So, and the walking tours are neat. And so we were having a lunch and this thing about why don't we do a fundraiser? I mean, a real fundraiser for the museum. And I had been at an event at where we saw an incredible band, a 17-piece big band, and a gentleman who was a neat guy. And we thought we would try this, and so it's grown and grown. And Chris has worked. I just go out and visit people and say, you want to go to a dance. You know?
Yeah, right. So we'll get to some details in a little bit. So, again, that's the night of the speakeasy, February 10th, at Racine Civic Center Festival Hall. And it's going to be an exciting night that's going to bring the 1920s alive. I want to talk about, Chris, some of what people see when they walk into the Racine Heritage Museum in terms of this important story that you tell. And of course, at the heart and soul of it is this notion of Racine as a city of extraordinary invention and inventors. And I suspect that your exhibit called Racine County Factory for the World seeks to tell that story primarily.
That's right. And as you move through the museum, you know, we do tell our stories. Racine County, the entire county, not just the city, and the East and the West had this remarkable relationship that developed early on in the community's history, where the whole part of it is that, you know, the whole story of it is that wheat is produced in the western part of the county and shipped in the eastern part. And there was this remarkable infrastructure that developed around that, and people employed that and their business relationships in creative ways very early on to aid and support escaping slaves along the Underground Railroad to, you know, through Burlington and through places in the western part of the county to our very, very busy commercial port where people could find their way to freedom, you know, via the Great Lakes. You will see, moving forward, you will see a host, a variety of amazing inventions and learn about the relationships between and among different manufacturers in the community. For instance, you know, Modine developed heat and air exchange products for Nash Automobiles. And if you find, you learn about Twin Disc, who's celebrating their 100th this year, and the products that they developed that, you know, worked their way into Wallace and tractors right away. And just fascinating stories and relationships among these different manufacturers that spurred new innovation. And that really continues to be our story.
Interesting. And, of course, you're telling the story not only of industries that are still present, that still are alive and well and thriving, but of course also the story of industry that is no longer present.
Right.
And were it not for something like the Racine Heritage Museum, chances are even the typical Racinian would have no idea some of what's gone on there.
Right. You know, you wouldn't know perhaps that this was the biggest luggage producing community in the country. There were fractional horsepower motors were invented here. And over time, there were probably 200 to 250 different manufacturers using fractional horsepower motors in all kinds of ways. You know, most of these were small, you know, 1, 2, 3-person operations, but some of them were very big, Hamilton Beach and Oster. And now we have companies like Multi Products that continue that legacy.
What was sort of the general means by which the museum has gained, especially some of the really remarkable, eye-catching artifacts that are part of your collection? Or is it difficult to even summarize? I suppose there's all kinds of different ways that a museum can come into possession of such things.
Well, the collection itself dates to the beginnings of it date to 1870 with the founding of the Old Settler Society. There were a group of people that were kind of early, you know, city and county settlers, and they were getting old, so they organized around that notion, and they started to, they were proud of their story, they're proud of what they'd accomplished. And their pride kind of carries through the story of this community, where you do, you have people coming from all over the world for all sorts of reasons, and they're bringing all sorts of amazing skills with them, and they're coming here and creating amazing products and taking risks and you know, kind of launching out with great ideas. And they're people in this community, people in the county are proud of their accomplishments. And it's out of that pride that, and you know, rightly so, that they took an interest in saving their own stories. And so we do have we've got an extremely extensive permanent collection in our care because of that.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Chris Paulson, Executive Director of the Racine Heritage Museum, and Jim Wardrop's with us as well. He's on the planning committee for their major fundraiser that's coming up on February 10th, a night at the Speakeasy, which we'll talk about further in just a moment. Chris, I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to talk about another exhibit that's at the Racine Heritage Museum that I think a lot of people would find most intriguing, called This Train is Bound for Glory, an exhibit that has actually nothing whatsoever to do with trains, but about a story that's just as important but very different from what we think of as trains.
Sure. Well, it's about it's been a major draw for us. It continues to be, and it put us on the map nationally within the National Park Service when they created their Underground Railroad network to freedom. This is a story that details Racine County's involvement as both you know, kind of an important local and even national abolitionist population, but also it details some very compelling stories of people escaping along the Underground Railroad, one of which gathered some very strong national attention following the Fugitive Slave Act. The exhibit is based on nearly two decades of research that we conducted with our partner organization, the Professional Women's Network for Service, to establish Racine County as a significant player in the Underground Railroad and abolitionist movement. And through that effort and through that exhibit and through some other work we've done in the community, Racine County has two sites that are identified, and the museum is a recognized facility within that National Park Service Underground Railroad network, and we are the only county west of Cincinnati that has two identified sites with that network. So it's a significant piece of what we offer.
And are you saying that there are two very specific, like, geographical sites that were part of that network known as the Underground Railroad?
That's right. With the sort of substantial documentation to support that. Monument Square being one of them. Of course, it was Haymarket Square at the time, where the story of Joshua Glover takes place in Racine, a fugitive slave that was captured. He was living and working in a sawmill along Root River, and captured by federal marshals, taken to Milwaukee. Racine leaders and a huge gathering took place at Monument Square, Haymarket Square. They went up to Milwaukee to join the crowds to bust him out of jail and get him to freedom. And ultimately, they succeeded, and Mr. Glover was kind of scuttled around in, 130 miles over four counties, and eventually made his way to Canada, where he lived out his life as a free person. The people in Racine County got in a lot of trouble for that, because they were in violation of the Fugitive Slave Act. Ultimately, the the state kind of refused to persecute them further. This went all the way up to the Supreme Court, who filed against the state of Wisconsin. The state refused to accept the filing, and it was the first and only time that a state has refused to accept a Supreme Court decision. Wow. And it starts here in Racine County.
Wow. And so that's one of the remarkable stories told in this exhibit, again, called This Train is Bound for Glory.
It's kind of interesting also. I'll throw it point out is that I discovered that Chris has staff members that interview octogenarians and older people in the city of Racine about their heritage. About they've talked with Chuck Tyler, but other people in the community, whether it be Armenians or Danes or whatever, where you sit down with a person that has a lot of years on and talks about what Racine was or how they came, how their family came here and everything else. And all this is being recorded, and it's really kind of interesting to me that 20 years from now you're going to have actual person talking about what it was like in 1910 or that type of thing.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah, our curator of education has undertaken a major, emphasis on collecting oral histories, and over the past year and a half, and has just gathered some wonderful stories, and does it. she does it very well. So the stories that we do gather are, there's a lot of cohesion to them, I'm really looking forward to the body of knowledge, to seeing what we can do with that, throughout the museum, to sort of punch up our program. I know that some of the work she's doing is already bearing fruit in some intergenerational emphases as part of our educational program at the museum. And I just see a whole lot of potential for that down the road.
Wonderful. And that project is
That is ongoing.
Right, right. And who in particular ends up being spoken to? I mean, is it just about anybody who's lived a long life here in Racine and has stories to tell?
Well, you'd be surprised how many people Jim knows. It just...
So, actually, I wouldn't.
We started this with a list. I've had a list of people that I've been wanting to collect stories from that's been growing for years, and then you know you meet people through the people you interview. You know, there's
of course
it kind of evolves it organically. But it also, you know, it's been wonderful for us because we've met new people. We none of us knows everything about everybody either.
Right. Fascinating. I know you also have an exhibit called Waterways that tells the story of Racine as a harbor point. And, of course, that's a very much tied up in also this being a city of innovation and a means to kind of share those innovations with the world, I should think.
That's right. Well, people have been living along the river and you know, kind of taking advantage of the fresh water and the protection of this area for the last 15,000 years. And this story begins there and details, of course, the more recent, you know, our community now, but Racine as a major commercial port. It was the fifth busiest commercial port on the Great Lakes for a while. Racine as a boat manufacturing center. Racine, and of course, all the industries that sort of pop up, you know, around the harbor and around a you know a busy, active port, and the conversion to a recreational harbor. Mm. In the 1980s and what that's meant for our community as well.
Fantastic.
It's interesting, real quick, like, is the Racine Boat Company was in Racine. And if you go out to Lake Geneva and you see a couple of the launches, the beautiful ones with mahogany, the boats that are for set up at the at that main dock, those are Racine Boat Company boats.
Huh?
And that were initially steam driven and that type of thing, but they're just works of art. And you look at that, and again, I guess you could probably have the Racine Heritage Museum called the I didn't know that museum because people will go, I didn't know that the and
right
know, these
that this happened here
and
that
stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I like that very very much. We've already mentioned that the historical walking tours are operated under your auspices. You also have control of the 1888 Bohemian schoolhouse that many people have visited over the years. I want you to say a quick word about something that I did not realize is part of the museum, a tribute that you have to astronaut Laurel Clark.
Yes, it's a biographical exhibit that we installed a number of years ago. And going back to the notion that we want people to know that they're in a special community when they walk into the museum. The exhibit on Laurel Clark is our way of asking and answering the question, what does a person who kind of takes on the unique spirit of this community behave like? What is their story? And while Laurel Clark only lived here a couple of years, graduated from high school, she identified Racine as her hometown for the remainder of her life. And you know, it's a wonderful connection that she had to the community, but we look at the decisions that she made and the work that she did and how she sort of embodied that spirit of you know, kind of a sense of wonder and discovery and, you know, the things that undergird everything from the risks that people took along the Underground Railroad to the innovative and entrepreneurial spirit that sort of permeates everything else in this community.
Nicely said. So the idea came forth maybe from Mr. Wardrop, actually, that yes. That a fundraiser would be helpful for the Racine Heritage Museum. Towards what end? What would be sort of the biggest reason for a major fundraiser? I mean, assuming that this is a fundraiser that will be successful and generate some funds, what would be your hopes for the use of funds raised by this event coming up on February 10th?
We are the custodian of an enormous collection of Racine County's material culture. This collection is held in trust for the people of Racine County. It's comprised of some 200,000 objects and over a mile of linear feet of original source documentary material. This is an amazing, extensive collection of our shared history. The support that we generate through this and through other events during the year directly goes to the care of that collection, to its longevity, to ensuring its safety, and to giving us the opportunity to share the stories that are contained in that collection with people through exhibits and through a very active education program. We serve an audience, roughly 30,000 people a year, and through direct educational activities, that number, about 6,500 individuals through, these are students and seniors through direct programs. And these funds support our ongoing efforts to continue to showcase and celebrate that story, care for the collection, and reach people.
Excellent. So this is an important event for an important cause. Again, it's February 10th, a night at the Speakeasy. Jim Wardrop, where did you get the idea of this being the focus for this fundraiser?
That was Chris's idea.
Oh,
we're just coming up. I think one of the neat things was there's going to be three automobiles on display that were made in Racine. I didn't know that, you know. But you have a Mitchell motor car, you have a Case sedan, and also a Nash. 1927 automobiles.
So these are cars that are part of the museum's collection, but you don't have room to typically display them.
Very limited in the space that we have. There's one car, a 1905 Mitchell, that you'll find in the museum, and you know, you take a look around, you can see very clearly that that car came right up the stairs. So yeah, there's no loading dock there. And these cars, this is the first time that they've ever been exhibited together. We're able to show them to the public only rarely, and you know, just, you know, perhaps a first Friday or something like that, or in the parade. But this is your chance to kind of get up close and take a look at these
beautiful cars. Get a picture with them or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be other things there as well. So when you're coming to this event, you're going to be able to see some Racine, made in Racine products, some history. Visually, you'll see some things perhaps like what downtown Racine looked like in the 20s or that type of thing. The other thing is that we're bringing in this 17-piece big band. Jack Farina, he's a music teacher out at Beloit College. And he has this group that is known throughout the upper Midwest.
Absolutely.
And he has arrangements of all of the, from bands from 1920s up to the late 50s. You name the band, it's there. Nothing by Two-Ton Baker, though, the music maker. Those of you folks listening in Chicago. And then we have a dinner going. I talked with one of the people as we were talking about explaining what the event was, and the lady said, "Let me get this straight. You're going to have a concert, a 3-hour concert going with a 17-piece big band, and I get a dinner, and then also I get hors d'oeuvres and before the dinner with a trio, piano, bass, and drums playing. And it's going to cost me $75. And I said, yes. She said, well, a concert ticket for a big band like that cost more than half of that. So we're just really, really excited to make something like this an annual event, also to highlight the museum and that point. I didn't know we had that. And so we're really looking forward to that. And You can contact the museum. Chris, where could I buy a ticket?
You can contact the museum this week. It's 262-636-3926. Give us a call. You can sign up on the museum's website through Eventbrite. It's safe and easy. RacineHeritageMuseum.org. You can find the link. We'll take you right there. you can stop in, but we want to make it as easy as possible for anybody because there's still room. Give us a call. Check online. And we'll make sure we get you into the event.
And if someone wants to dress up in the 20s, we aren't going to kick them out.
So. Yes, costumes are encouraged. Yeah. They're not required, but it would be really great to see. We do have a Racine-made flapper dress that will be part of the exhibit of...
Really?
Yes, part of the exhibit of some of the materials we have and some other cool 1920s stuff from the museum's collection as well.
Wow. And I imagine that when you choose that particular decade as your focus, not only visually does it offer a lot of fun opportunities and musically and so on, but I suspect that was a decade of a lot of activity in Racine. I mean, there's all kinds of stories you can tell when you pick a decade like
that. Oh, sure, absolutely. We're learning too. It's been a lot of fun learning our own local stories and then learning some of this 1920s lingo too, like giggle water.
Giggle water.
Which will be served at the cash bar.
Interesting. All right. Well, on that enigmatic note, then, we want to remind everybody once again of this major fundraiser coming up for the Racine Heritage Museum on February 10th at Racine Civic Center Festival Hall. The Jack Farina Big Band, a wonderful, wonderful group out of Beloit, is going to be offering the entertainment that night. Three automobiles that are part of the museum's collection, but typically not on display for the public, will be on display along with all kinds of artifacts from the 1920s. People can come in 1920s regalia if you are so inclined. But one way or another, it's a great way for you to support the Racine Heritage Museum and to have a whole lot of fun. And for any other information, you can go to the Racine Heritage Museum's website, which is really lovely and gives a lot of information on everything we've talked about and more. And what is that website address again?
RacineHeritageMuseum.org.
Very good. Chris Paulson is the executive director of the Racine Heritage Museum, and Jim Wardrop, a whirling dervish of energy behind the scenes, one of the primary organizers of this fundraiser coming up on February 10th, a night at the Speakeasy.
Greg,
gentlemen, Greg, this has been a fun conversation.
Thank you so much for having us. Really
thank you,
appreciate
Greg.
It.
Good to have
Thanks
you here. Part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. The time is exactly 8:43. Forty-four here on WGTD, and part two of today's program, we want to step from a feature that was on today's morning edition from National Public Radio. They are going to be spending a great deal of time looking back 50 years to the year 1968, which was, of course, a most eventful year here in the United States, and one of the things that was talked about in today's morning edition was a crucial turning point in the Vietnam War, the battle for the city of Hue. And as I listened to that, I remembered that I had the privilege of speaking with best-selling author Mark Bowden about his book, which is widely regarded as the definitive account of the battle for Hue. His book is titled Hue 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Here's that conversation out of the morning show archives with Mark Bowden. Mark Bowden, one of the decisions you made in telling the story of this important battle in the Vietnam War is to tell not only sort of the expansive canvas of the overall war and this great and important battle, but also the stories of individuals on both sides of the conflict. How challenging was that for you as the author to tell, in a sense, the big story and also all kinds of small individual stories to give this story kind of a different kind of life? How difficult was it to tell both of those stories together, in a sense?
Well, that's a great question, Greg, and that, of course, is the central challenge in doing this kind of book. I think most histories of battles take an overview, and you basically have an omniscient narrator who's describing troop movements and strategic decisions and, you know, critical turning points and whatnot, and it's important to have that knowledge. But I think if you want to make somebody read a story about a battle as sweeping as this, and this book is 600 pages long, if you want to keep people's interest and attention, you really need to write about the people who are most directly affected. And that means the private who's trembling in his boots, and it means the 18-year-old Vietnamese village girl who's learning how to fire an AK-47, and it means the families who are digging holes and trying to hide from the fighting and trying to survive. And that's what the battle is really about. So I try to build these stories from the ground up as opposed to from the top down.
I wonder if you could tell us about two of the people with whom you spoke, maybe one from each side of the conflict, if possible, where you came away with an especially sort of vivid, strong reaction to what they had shared with you about these events 50 years ago.
Sure. Start with one of the Vietnamese characters. His name is Nguyen Duc Huan. And Huan was an 18, 19-year-old student who was a devout Buddhist. He was opposed initially to the Saigon government, and because he was became a subject to arrest, fled and ultimately joined the Viet Cong. And even though he was a Buddhist, he accepted the importance of the liberation movement. He was very idealistic. He became a propagandist for the Viet Cong. And in the months that they occupied Hue, he got caught up in finding and punishing the people who had worked for or allied themselves with the Saigon regime. And he ends up in the middle of a bloodbath that he is partly orchestrating. In other words, he ends up in a place that he never imagined he would end up. And when I interviewed him for this book, he's an old man now, and he's, I think, tremendously ashamed of what happened when he was younger. And on the American side, there's Alvin Grantham, who in a very, very famous photograph in Life magazine of a bunch of wounded Marines on a tank is the young Marine with his shirt off who has been shot through the chest. And he's laid out on this tank, and he looks like he's dying. In fact, he survived. And his story of how he ended up in Vietnam, how he ended up in this battle, how he ended up shot through the chest, and then the great struggle to survive and lead a normal life, as to me, it's emblematic of the whole American experience in Vietnam.
One of the crucial elements to this battle, which was one of the bloodiest in the conflict, perhaps the bloodiest of all, is that the North Vietnamese completely surprised the South Vietnamese and the Americans. How were they able to achieve such a complete and utter surprise?
Well, I think for a number of reasons, Greg. The first being that they were very good at what they were doing. The North Vietnamese Army had fought against the French. They were not newcomers to infantry combat, so they were skillful. And secondly, I think you can't assemble a force of 10,000 men around a city without the locals noticing. And the fact is that in the months before the Tet Offensive, when all these troops were being filtered into South Vietnam, not a single alarm was sounded to the ARVN forces, that's the South Vietnamese forces, or the American forces. And I think that tells you something about the degree of popular support in South Vietnam, especially in the countryside, for the liberation cause, if not for the communist cause, for the cause of independence. And I think it was very telling, and it's one of the reasons why the American forces were not just surprised. I think this was a deep blow to their ambitions.
Mm. Describe Hue itself and why it made sense for this particular offensive to take place there. Why Hue?
Well, the Tet Offensive, as we know, was actually a countrywide one, and actually more than 100 cities and towns were attacked. But the big effort was for Hue, and that's because Hue was the ancient capital of the United Country of Vietnam. And what Hanoi was advertising with this offensive was not the North taking over the South, but rather the liberation of the entire country, freeing Vietnam from foreign domination. And Hue is sort of the symbol of Vietnam as a united country. It's also the cultural and religious capital of Vietnam. The Hue University is there, and historic pagodas. This is where the emperor's palace was, inside this great fortress of the citadel. So taking Hue had tremendous symbolic importance in South Vietnam, and I think really undermined the confidence that the South Vietnamese had in the government in Saigon.
I think one of the most fascinating points you make, which I had not remembered reading about before, was the nature of the special flag that was raised. Was it over the citadel itself?
Yep.
North Vietnamese came in, that was not a flag that represented North Vietnam, but represented, in a sense, something greater. And this was by very specific and careful design.
Exactly, and it goes back to the point I was making. You know, they didn't want the South Vietnamese to perceive this as an invasion of the North into the South. They wanted the people of South Vietnam to identify with the effort as a liberation movement. This was a movement for independence. So they designed a new flag, and it combined elements of the North Vietnamese flag with representations of the intellectuals and the religious people in Hue. In other words, it was supposed to be an emblem for a popular movement, and it flew over the citadel for almost a month.
What is truly bewildering and in a sense maddening is the kind of response to this from the leadership of the American military. Explain to our listeners how this was regarded by them, seemingly, in what seems to be maybe a dual exercise in both deception and self-deception.
Yeah. You know, and people say to me, how could General Westmoreland have lied? And I don't think he was lying. The American command was convinced that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong lacked the capability of doing something like Tet, or particularly of taking Hue. And when they in fact did it, instead of acknowledging that they were wrong, Westmoreland denied it. And he wasn't just denying it to reporters as some sort of public relations gambit. He was denying it in cables to Washington, to the president and to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was as though he wasn't capable of accepting that it had happened. And this was a denial that had terrible consequences, because young American Marines and soldiers were being ordered to attack a force that was many times greater than their own and that was entrenched, firing down at them from walls of this great citadel and from ramparts. They didn't have a chance. So the young American company commanders who I interviewed, who later retired as generals, look back on it as a time of really terrible betrayal by their own command that sent them out on what were essentially suicide missions, and then would accuse them of cowardice and timidity when they didn't succeed.
Right. And it was one suicide mission after another, one after another. I mean, the unnecessary loss of life is just staggering. Many times this has been described as a turning point in the Vietnam War, that is, this battle at Hue. But you go further to say that this is also a turning point in American history. You see the ramifications stretching far beyond the conflict itself. In what way was this a turning point in our nation's history?
Well, I think I can say that, Greg, because I lived it. I mean, I grew up in the 1950s, and in the early 1960s, the United States was this tremendously powerful force in the world. It was the champion of freedom all over the world. And, you know, I think, like many Americans, I had a tremendous amount of faith in our political and military leaders. Vietnam exposed the fact that the American public was being manipulated and lied to. And it didn't have, as I said, just public relations consequences. It had real consequences in the loss of life in Vietnam. And I think that, you know, the Tet Offensive and the Battle of Hue really shook America's confidence, not just in the war, but in the president and in the leadership in Vietnam. And frankly, it was one of what became a series of blows to confidence in our government. Watergate came some years later. And I think we've never really changed that much as a nation since. We live with a great deal of skepticism. Some of it is very healthy toward the official line about anything. I think it really is a turning point in the character of this country.
You mentioned in the acknowledgments that Vietnam was the first major international event that captured your interest as a child. And you go so far as to say that it may be part of what ultimately prompted you to become the journalist that you are to this very day. Just say a word about how you took in these events as a young person.
Well, you know, back in the 60s, there was no talk radio or 24/7 cable TV or internet. And, you know, I got my news by, you know, reading Life magazine or looking at a newspaper. And I remember arguing with my dad, who was a smart guy. He was in favor of the war, and I was against it. And neither of us, frankly, knew enough to have a strong opinion. But he would always say to me, how do you know that? Why do you believe that? And so that prompted me to start going to the library and finding books about the subject, about the history of Southeast Asia. I started reading the newspaper. I subscribed to Time magazine and would devour it from cover to cover. And, you know, and eventually it led me to some of the great books on the subject, and, you know, by people like Francis Fitzgerald and David Halberstam. And I was inspired by the kind of work they were doing. So it's certainly one of the things that led me down a road to a career reporting and writing.
How long did it take you to finish this astonishing book?
Well, thank you. And it took me 6 years. I think in the beginning, you know, I was reading everything I could find to see what was out there already and what was known. And then I began interviewing people, Americans first. And then I hired a gentleman named Dang Hoa Ho in Vietnam to begin researching and finding people to interview in that country. And so, you know, it just sort of picked up steam, but it took me 6 years to finish.
It's an extraordinary book. Again, Hue, 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam, published by Atlantic Monthly Press, the author Mark Bowden. Congratulations, Mark Bowden, on an amazing book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow.